You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. Usually about the week in sports narratives, but we have yet another
not today
special stat school. That person you're hearing admonish me is Kate Fagan. Hello, Kate.
Hey, Chad.
Porting in from book leave yet again. Also with me is Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Sports writer for 538. So we are doing a stat school. It is a pre-taped stat school, but that doesn't mean the lesson is any less fresh. Neil,
this stuff is
timeless.
I mean, this is like
timeless lesson.
Right. Yeah. This is,
it's like one of those things that we've like from the future sort of like sucked out all the air.
Yes, dehydrated. Ooh.
And then we're just going to bring it back to life.
This, you know, is, astronauts eat that.
Yes.
So.
This is dehydrated
we're
risotto
like
that we're about to serve
or
up
something.
Right here.
Ooh, the ice cream of the future.
The melting begins right now. Neil, what flavor of Dippin' Dots have you brought us today?
Basketball flavored Dippin' Dots.
Ooh,
that
tasty.
Sounds like they would be very disgusting.
Orange and
black. Leathery.
Just, yeah, a whole lot. So we're going to talk about basketball. We're going to kind of do the basic stats 101 of what to look for in advanced metrics for basketball players.
On offense, defense, everything?
We're going to do offense today.
Save defense,
you know,
for another dip and dot outing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Another dip.
All right, Kate, are you ready? Statman is here. Cape is on.
Dun, da, da, da.
We've put aside the vigil that we built for you. We hid it from you so you didn't get embarrassed while you were on book leave of seeing just how large the vigil had grown. I'm ready to be educated. Are you ready to be educated?
I'm ready.
All right. Neil, statsplain us.
Okay. Hopefully that's not like mansplaining. But who knows?
It's not.
Reader,
it's not.
Listeners, please tell me. Readers also, you know, all of the
podcast. If you're reading this podcast, let us know.
Reading the podcast.
We are getting punchy after three straight podcasts.
That's right. It's been a marathon podcast day. So the first thing that we kind of have to talk about is, you know, we always go in these stat schools to what they were sort of judging players on back in 1975 or what have you. So, you know, we got to go points per game. We got to talk about the old school and players being judged just strictly by your scoring output, like, you know, can you fill the basket with basketballs and Dippin' Dot flavored basketballs? And so, you know, that for a long time was one of the primary ways in which a player was judged. And you would sort of fill in the gaps around it with the eye test of, you know, was a guy good at defense? Well, let's watch him. Let's see, you know, does he keep his man in front of him? You know, is he good at rebounding? Maybe we bring in rebounds per game. But it's all about the per game numbers, and it all revolves around that number that if you hit 20 on, you know, in points per game, you're going to get paid. And that's sort of the end of the discussion. And that was the way that it was always done for the longest time.
Okay, and so that, I mean, that had some appeal to me, I think. Like, I want to know, especially in basketball, where the best players are playing more minutes. We talked in football that maybe the best running backs aren't playing the most number of downs. Or sorry, that if you are a really good running back at certain rate stats that you're not necessarily going to play as often. In basketball, I feel like it's pretty rare for someone, especially who can score a lot, to be sitting on the bench for large swaths of the game. And so per game feels like there is some meaning to that. For that, to me, okay. When you were playing basketball, did you care about your per game points?
Yeah, I did. We all had to pretend that we didn't care,
right?
And pretend that we didn't know during the game how many points we had.
You totally knew.
Oh my god!
Totally.
Well, no. I mean,
track.
First of all, I wasn't scoring like enough to lose track. But I love when a teammate would be like, oh, I don't count points in my head. I'm just so focused on the game. I'm like, liar. Come on.
Shut
like,
the
you
hell
know,
up.
You know when you have like 8 points. How do you not know if you have 8 points? Like,
right.
You're pretty sure you have 8 points. But, you know, I was just thinking, it's interesting because points per game was the thing, and this was like late 90s, early 2000s, like they're just advanced stats, at least in the college basketball world. They didn't trickle down to me if they existed.
Ken Pomeroy wasn't.
It kind of framed how I. No, Ken Pom. It kind of framed how I thought of the game and how I played the game. It was like points per game, and therefore as I was playing, everything sort of was focused on how many points I might score in scoring. Whereas now, I honestly think now you can see some players are, you've given them a different framework to process the game. And I just think mentally it's different when you're like, oh, we're measuring all these different things now. I actually think that that affects you when you're playing.
I think that's right. And maybe this will transition into the next section. But now I feel like the way that analytics has involved the game, at least like from a player statistical point of view, I think, you know, in the past you would be told to, you know, that you're a defensive player and you were told that, you know, your job was to rebound. But it's a lot easier to do those roles when there are numbers that you can kind of trust will be rewarded in those categories. And I think in the past, even if you were some kind of specialist, you still, like, in the back of your mind wanted to get those points because you knew at the end of the day, especially as an NBA player, that was what was going to get you paid and that was how you would be judged. And so, you know, it's all well and good for the coach to say, go out here, you know, play good interior D, grab some rebounds. But you know that when the contract negotiations come up, they're going to point to the fact that you only scored like 10 points per game. And then they'll be like, look, we're only going to pay you about a little over the league minimum. You'd be like, but coach, I did all the things you said. But, you know, that was the way it was back then.
Okay, so I feel like I have a pretty good grasp of points per game because it's almost so obvious. Do we want to go and talk about protagonists who are going to guide us through these three levels of stats of increasing complexity now, or do you want to wait, Statman, until we're at the second course
so
offering?
I mean,
so that we can sort of mix
we
and
are
match,
your disciples.
Contrast to compare.
Well, I think let's just mix and match then. Let's talk about some guys that maybe look really good by points per game and probably would have, you know, a far better reputation in the past than they do right now, given their, you know, advanced stats. So we have people, the prototype for this is someone that, you know, has a really high usage rate, and that's a stat that we should also define. It's the percentage of the team's possessions or plays that the player sort of takes upon himself and tries to score with while he's on the floor. This is a stat that you can find at Basketball Reference.
And it's just scoring, it's not passing?
There are various flavors of it where you can kind of track the total number of possessions or share of possessions that a player has that includes like assists and things like that. The one that they list at Basketball Reference is the one that I'm going to use now, and it just looks at like times that you tried to score. So, you know, shot attempts and free throw attempts off of, you know, if you got fouled while trying to shoot, and then did you turn the ball over? And it doesn't give you credit for the fraction of a possession that you preserve when you get an offensive rebound, or, you know, if you played a role in passing to someone who did score. Those aren't really reflected. So it's kind of a pure scoring stat, and that's better for our purposes anyway because we're talking about points per game. But I want to focus on Monte Ellis, who's a guy that the advanced stats, you know, especially early in his career, really vilified because he showed this difference between, you know, he scored 18 points per game over the past couple of years, and he did it with a really low rate of efficiency, no matter really the metric that you look at. His true shooting percentage, which is a measure of sort of like the points that you generate per shot, was only around 0.5. And the league average is higher than that because more than 1 point sort of results per shot on average.
So I feel like we just jumped into the next level by talking about true shooting percentage,
sure.
Right? Okay, so you're saying that Ellis is true shooting percentage was 0.5, and that's the points per shot?
Yeah, it's like the it's scaled to resemble a percentage. So basically, you take the number of points the player produces per shot attempt, which includes free throw attempts, some fraction of free throw attempts, and you divide it in two, and that's how you get the true shooting percentage. It's not a real percentage, which is sort of a confusing aspect of it, but it's designed to sort of put it on a scale where it's kind of the same as field goal percentage, where you're kind of looking at like 0.5 is around average. In the case of true shooting percentage, it's a little less than average. But then if you're getting up into like 0.6 or 0.55, 55%, 60%, you're looking at a guy who's really being efficient with the times that he tries to score.
So Monta Ellis has a high point per game. And then we...
That's right.
Okay.
And a high
but
usage
a, but
rate.
A poor true right. shooting percentage.
But a poor true shooting percentage.
I'm sorry. I'm still stuck on the 0.5.
Sure.
That's 0.5 points
expected per shot? Points per shot.
It's again, it's really confusing because the it's kind of you take the expected points per shot and then you cut it in half to get something that looks like a basketball shooting percentage that we all kind of know, like field goal percentage. So I'm not even sure what the units are, but if you multiply by two, he's averaging essentially 1 point per shot.
Ah, thank you. Okay.
If we want to take it to that level.
Got
and
it.
Just to give you a little more context of what that actually means, the league's true shooting percentage last season was 0.53. So they averaged about 1.06 points per shot.
Okay, and that factors in threes and whatever else.
So Monta, he's a baller. He's scoring points.
Except he's not doing it very efficiently.
That's right. And the next level of sort of development that happened when people started looking at advanced stats, they first looked at them at the team level, and they found out that it's really good to measure a team sort of independent of the pace at which it plays, and that's defined in advanced stats as the number of possessions that the team, you know, has per 48 minutes. So you could have a team that only scores like 85 points per game, and you think, oh, they're really bad offensively, but then you have to know how many possessions they did that in. They could just play a really slow pace, and you should be sort of indifferent as to whether you have a slow pace or a fast pace as long as you're maximizing the number of possessions, because the crucial insight that people had at the very beginning of basketball analytics was the unit of the game, the basic currency of it, is the possession, and both teams have the same number of possessions per game if you don't give teams extra possessions for offensive rebounds. If you consider an offensive rebound to extend a possession rather than tacking on a new possession, then the only thing that can cause a difference in the number of possessions that each team has in a game is, you know, did they win the tip, and then also did they, you know, get the ball like an extra
clock
shot
expiring,
off at
right.
halftime or an
it
extra
can never
shot
be more
at the
than,
end of a quarter.
Than four. Four, I suppose.
Right. It can
two,
never be a difference be. Bigger yeah. than four.
So, okay. So, true shooting percentage then is something that I'm supposed to feel more fidelity, more faith in, have more faith in, because it's factoring in all of this, all the complexities of basketball. It's factoring in the fact that, usage rate matters, and that efficiency matters, and or no, you're
that's
waving
not
me
true,
off.
Actually.
Okay,
yeah. So
I think I'm struggling with lesson two then.
Right in line, you know, kind of in keeping with this realization that the currency is possessions. Then they started shifting to saying like, well, the efficiency of an offense is as a of a team's offense is how well does it turn those possessions into points on average. And so the natural leap that you make is you say, well, how efficiently is this player turning the possessions that he ends, that's usage rate, into points? And so Monte Ellis, with the low true shooting percentage, is not doing a very good job when he ends a team's possession or tries to score on a team's possession. And remember, possessions are really precious. Each one that a player uses up is one that one of his teammates could have used, and perhaps with more efficiency. And so if you're trying to maximize the efficiency of a team, it would seem that a player like Ellis, who does a, you know, below league average job of turning those possessions into points on average, is actually hurting the team in spite of his gaudy per game scoring output. Does that make more sense?
Yeah, it does. Go ahead.
It's kind of – well, I like how you're saying – I love how we like to pretend like we're students, and this time we're actually like, no, wait a second. But I like how you're talking about how it used to be before it felt like points were the metric in basketball.
Right, yeah. How many
and
points did your team
so
score?
You're like, okay, the Suns of the 90s, you know, they're really – or the Suns with Steve Nash, they're really high scoring – therefore, every player on their team will likely have a higher point per game than the defensive-minded Knicks of a different era. So it's like that's actually not the common denominator we need to look at.
Yeah.
Therefore, with Monta Ellis, we want to look at possession efficiency rather than just the fact that he is putting up big numbers. And because and he spent certain times in offenses, too, that had bigger numbers. Like when he was with the Warriors back in the day and they were more, well, they're still running gun, but they were scoring a lot, that he had 20 point per game averages.
Yeah, and that goes back to the pace that we talked about where, like, if you score a bunch of points, it really matters as to whether or not your pace was really high too, because that means that the other team had a really high pace when they were playing you. And so it doesn't really tell you how much you sort of separated yourself from the other team. And the goal, obviously, is to maximize maximize your scoring margin. And, you know, if all that you need to get those points is more possessions, then that means that the other team has more possessions and that they're scoring more points too. So you're not really getting anywhere. What you really want is to score more points with fewer possessions almost.
What I like about this is it treats possessions as a sacred thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that if I am a basketball player who's about, even in a pickup game, I suppose, right, and I'm about to shoot, I should treat that decision with real respect, right?
Like, so the probably not shoot then?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Exactly. This is my point. It's like, it's sort of, you know how people say, well, if you're going to kill an animal, like, you got to treat it well, respect it after whatever, and like make a good dish out of it or something. I feel like it's somewhat similar here. Like, if you're going to take a shot, make it a good shot, because your team only gets so many of these.
Yeah, you're never going to get that
possession
back.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't count offensive rebounds as a separate idea. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so Ellis, not good at true shooting percentage, good at points per game.
Yeah, and the players that are really good at true shooting percentage, or you could even take it to sort of a more convoluted version. We talked about how maximizing possessions at the individual level became sort of a thing. A guy who used to work with ESPN, Dean Oliver, and is kind of the godfather of basketball analytics, he came up with a formula to actually just measure the team's offensive, you know, efficiency as a whole when the player used up a possession. And that's the metric that includes, like, your passing, your offensive rebounding even, because it's worth something to sort of extend that possession. It doesn't use up a possession. It actually kind of adds to the team's possession. So he calls this offensive rating, and it mirrors the same stat for the team. You know, you can look up the Knicks' offensive rating. You can also look up Tyson Chandler's individual offensive rating. And if you look at the leaders in offensive rating in a given year, you're going to see sort of this very common thread that moves through them. You're going to see guys that are really effective, like three-point shooters, like a Kyle Korver, and in his day, Steve Kerr was someone who was just like lights out. Fred Hoiberg. These are players that annually led the league in offensive rating. And then you see big men who just spend all of their time around the basket, either putting in layups, dunking, or getting fouled. And that's like your Tyson Chandler, your Brandon Wright, your Tyler Hansbrough, your DeAndre Jordan, guys like that, where, you know, they're very efficient players in both types are very efficient players because they take the types of shots that yield the most points. Three-pointers, as we've learned, especially with the rise of the Warriors in the past few years and what Daryl Morey is doing in Houston, they're really valuable shots because they add that extra point, and they're not that much harder to make than, say, like a mid-range shot that is a few feet closer to the basket. And free throws, by definition, if you make a good enough percentage on them, they're going to just be this bonanza of, you know, efficiency, because they don't use up that many possessions on average, and they're pretty high percentage shots. If you get two free throws and you're shooting 70%, that's like 1.4 points per possession, roughly, even maybe a little bit more than that. And teams would kill for 1.4 points per possession in the open floor. So go ahead, Kate.
No, I'm getting philosophical over here, because there's a direct correlation between this movement in the NBA, and you're naming it now, all these statistics pointing out how you want good three-point shooters and you want good big men. And then we see now teams actually being built around this philosophy. And it's actually like the same philosophy that like media is adopting too. Is like, all right, we want to be the leaders in storytelling and lead the charge in new thinking, but we also want to be really good at the slam dunks, like quick hit news and viral and posting. And so, but you could actually stretch that out farther to be like, it's kind of like a life philosophy in a lot of ways. Like, you want to be really good and you want to take your chances and you want to be able to hit the home runs when you can, but you also need to kind of like stay close to home and take care of the things you need to take care of. And it's interesting that in basketball, obviously, before the invention/advent of the three-pointer, which changed everything, I'm assuming that that statistics would look very different in basketball if you pulled out the three-pointer. But it seems like a very common sense practice of like, take your long shots when you have to, but also shore things up, you know, on the inside.
Oh yeah, I think that's true. And gosh, if the three-pointer didn't exist, it would be so like I think it would be so different. And the big, maybe one of the reasons you saw big men dominate in the past before the three-pointer was introduced, like you had your, you know, Russells and your Wilt Chamberlains really be the focal points of teams, is that they were clearly the most valuable players. Their height alone and the fact that they could get such great position close to the basket meant that by definition, you know, there is no three-pointer to kind of balance it out for the little guy. It's all about getting the ball as close as possible, because the further you move away from that basket, defense notwithstanding, defensive pressure, it becomes a harder shot every successive foot that you move out. So, of course, you're going to want to be able to move the ball in as close as you can, and there's nothing to balance that out with like the three-point line. So maybe that's a sign that the game itself has reached like a really nice mix between the two. But I think the thing that's really interesting and the thing that will take us to the next level and what's so awesome about basketball is, if it was as easy as just getting the ball super close and then also having the shots from the outside, and the Hoibergs and the Chandlers of the world were truly the most valuable players, that would be kind of a boring game. Like there wouldn't be any nuance to it, because what really happens, there wouldn't be trade-offs. We have to take into account usage and the efficiency of a player. You can't have one and not the other. So you can't just look at Monte Ellis and he's all usage and really little efficiency comparatively, but you can't also fill your team with just nothing but Tyson Chandler's and Fred Hoiberg's, because someone has to score. And that brings us back around, I think.
Well, and this is what made Kyle Korver so good last year, right, was that he wasn't just standing around taking threes anymore. He's moving off the ball and starting to have a higher usage rate, if I remember correctly. And when either of those players, who are the inside dominance presence or the outside shooters, start to add more facets to their game, it makes them that much better and their usage rate that much more valuable, right?
Right, and Kyle Korver definitely improved his usage, but it still only reached 14%. And we should say that by definition, the average usage of all players in the NBA is 20%, because there's five mm-hmm. guys on the floor and you are one of those five. And so when things balance out, you're going to be taking 1/5 of all the shots. But what's really interesting is, take the Clippers. They have two players that are sort of at the opposite ends of the usage spectrum. They have DeAndre Jordan, who uses only like 13.6% of the possessions. And then they have Chris Paul, who uses 23.7% of the possessions, and they both have exactly the same usage. And the reason why Chris Paul is such a
the same
more
true shooting percent,
the same efficiency,
or the same efficiency. Sorry, yeah, the same true shooting percent is the same offensive rating. The reason why Paul is such a more valuable offensive player than Jordan is because he's able to maintain that immense level of efficiency that Jordan needs to be within a foot of the basket to maintain across like many different more situations. When he's passing the ball, when he's, you know, shooting mid-range jump shots, he is taking on such a bigger load in the offense and still maintaining that level of efficiency. That's why he is so much more valuable to have to an offense than someone like Jordan.
Alternatively, someone like Jordan, who knows his place, is also really valuable, right? Like,
right, because he's not trying to add usage rate, or at least maybe within the locker room he is pulling for more shots.
I think that came out over the summer.
That might have been part of the whole Dallas Mavericks thing. But there's also the same thing, you know, we were talking about with running backs and whether you need to get them more carries if they have more yards per carry, because are you going to get that same level of return, but then you kind of intrinsically know it's going to diminish. With Jordan, it's kind of like he is at the complete thread the needle spot for how many shots he should get and the return you get on him. And if all of a sudden you started running everything through him, that would be problematic as well for the Clippers.
Oh, yeah. And there have been studies that show that there's this diminishing returns effect, where if you take a guy who has low usage and you start funneling more plays through him, his efficiency starts to deteriorate. Because if you think about it, it just makes sense. The types of shots that he has in his game right now are maximized for that efficiency, but now you're going to be asking him to do other things, like move a little bit further out, create shots for himself. And one of the things about Kyle Korver is that he was one of the highest assisted players in the league. Like, the highest proportion of his field goals were assisted of, you know, just about any player. That's a type of player that, A, can really not ever get to huge like Steph Curry levels of usage without drastically changing the types of shots that he's taking. And if you start to ask players to be assisted on less of their shots, they're going to have to start creating things for themselves, and that also dings your efficiency. So there's no way around it. You have to actually sort of either get a lot better and start adding a lot of more shots to your arsenal. And maybe that's something Steph Curry's done since the first year he entered the league. He was already really good, but now he's become almost unguardable. And my colleague Ben Morris always talks about this, is the fact that he is so good at pull-up jump shots. He's like off the charts compared to other players in the league. That's, he's assisting himself in essence on those shots. And that is like a sort of easy way for him to sort of increase his usage without hurting his efficiency. And yet no other player in the league, or hardly any other players in the league, can actually do that and use that sort of hack. So it's all about finding ways to sort of find that equilibrium between how much usage can I as a player take on without seeing my efficiency fall off a cliff. And there may be something of, in addition to just like a normal diminishing return, there may be some point at which if you, the move from like, if you're Korver, from like 20 to 25% of possessions, may your efficiency may fall off like exponentially more than it would fall off if you move from like 15 to 20% of possessions.
Do you think it's fair to say that in a way, some of the most, I don't know if the word is worst or damaging players in the NBA are those who are not aware of what that point is for them when they're used, like, because if you look at Monta Ellis, like, there must be a point where his usage and his efficiency are actually productive for a team until it gets too high. And yet there are certain players who, to reach the point per game level that they are used to, feels like they think their usage needs to be higher even though their efficiency is so low.
Right. And this is almost one of the secrets of basketball team building is, it, you know, obviously we would love to have a LeBron or a Steph Curry who had the super high usage and the super high efficiency, but I think in the more kind of normal day-to-day course of running a basketball team, you have to find, if you're blessed with someone like a Tyson Chandler who only uses up 12% of the possessions, you have to find guys that will like soak up the rest of the possessions, and that's their role.
And do it efficiently.
And do it with some level. Like Monta Ellis would be good for a team that had a bunch of low usage guys because he can soak it up without losing too much, and that's his value. And maybe the highest level stat that we'll talk about is plus minus, adjusted plus minus, where you actually measure, given the talent of the other players on the team, the guy's impact on the team's efficiency. And someone like Monta Ellis actually has like a mildly positive influence on the team's efficiency. Or Victor Oladipo, you know, these guys who have the super low efficiency. And so in the past, we would have been like, oh, your usage is way too high. You're a bum. You're taking away opportunities. And the classic example is like maybe an Isaiah Thomas in the late course of his career when he started sort of becoming like high usage but not as high efficiency. Or Allen Iverson is a great example. You surround Allen Iverson with like George Lynch and Dikembe Mutombo, someone has to take those possessions and do it without a level of loss of efficiency that would tank. So maybe Allen Iverson being at like 30% of possessions, which or 35%, which is like near the league lead, and maintaining an average use or average efficiency is super valuable when you take into account the context of the guys who are around him or who are all low usage players who have pretty good efficiencies. He is actually enabling them to have that pretty good level of efficiency as a team because he is saying, like, look, guys, you don't have to step outside your comfort zone. I'm willing to sort of take on the shots. And, of course, that can be belabored a little bit because Allen Iverson is such a, you know, polarizing figure, and he loved taking shots. There's no two ways about it. But I think he got sort of crucified in the early days of advanced stats that focused only on efficiency. They didn't take into account the value of him sort of opening up opportunities for his teammates. And if you look at the plus-minus, he was actually pretty good offensive contributor.
So I feel like we hit real plus minus, Neil. We've reached the third the third level of our curriculum. Is that right?
I feel like this was actually like a 5-step
process. Yeah, no, this one, I think I said during the football stats school, football is really complicated. This, I mean, basketball, it seems as complicated to me, though perhaps easier to get a handle.
I think we have better tools.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe
it's like, it's because it's five people, we can kind of measure everything.
Right.
But also, it's really complicated.
Absolutely. Okay, so, Kate, I feel like I know more about what I want out of a basketball player now, and it's partly depending on what's surrounding them, as Neil just said, with the other players that are surrounding them on a team. Yeah. Are you with me?
Oh, I feel like I learned a lot. And I still think we can do a stat school basketball part two.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, of course. We're going to touch on defense. And
right. Even just with, with offense.
I also just want to hear more about Kate's new self-help book about how basketball is the way to how layups versus three-pointers is a way
to
organize your own
life. I like to be good at the challenging things, but also take care of the little things. All right, just you got to push yourself, but also take care of the little things.
I love
mentality.
I love
Thank you.
All right, I feel good. Thanks, Statman.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
What, 22,000 words now you're at with your book?
21,500.
Oh, this was more engrossing than the football one?
The football one I was just writing on the side. Yeah. This one I actually want to be part of the conversation.
Our podcast producer is Sarah Patterson, also still our intern. As well, our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Jordan Shulkin and Lois St. Jock. Our executive producer is Jody Abergin. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.